Support comes from Kappa, presenting an evening with Fran Lebowitz, March 6th at the Southern Theater. The evening will feature an unapologetically opinionated talk moderated by Ann Fisher, audience Q&A, and book signing. Tickets at kappa.com.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Many of the dietary supplements U.S. consumers spend roughly $50 billion on a year are marketed as natural alternatives for heart health and cholesterol management. New research by the Cleveland Clinic has found that that might be a waste of money. Dr. Steven Nissen is senior author of the study. He is the chief academic officer of the Heart, Vascular, and Thoracic Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. Welcome to the show, Dr. Nissen.
Thank you so much, Anne, and it's good to be here with you.
We're talking about over-the-counter dietary supplements like fish oil and garlic pills. My mom took fish oil. What are they saying? What are they alleging these things do?
Well, this has been going on for many years, about 30 years. In 1994, a law was passed known as the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, or DSHEA. And what DSHEA did is it removed responsibility for dietary supplements from the FDA and put it in the hands of the Federal Trade Commission. Now, the Federal Trade Commission is not a scientific body. They manage, you know, financial things, not science. And so there's no expertise. That was done with lots of lobbying from the dietary supplement industry to prevent the appropriate regulation of dietary supplements. And so if you really watch carefully the ads that appear on television or in newspapers, they say promotes heart health, which is kind of vague. It's not really specific. And what it's important for your listeners to know is that it's nearly 100% nonsense. There's no science. There are no rigorous clinical trials. There's no good scientific evidence that any of these dietary supplements do anything for heart health. And there's a huge problem here, is the supplements are diverting patients away from well-proven effective therapies toward therapies that really don't have any effect at all.
You know, I don't think I my mom is deceased now, so I'll talk about it. I think she was recommended to take the fish oil by her doctor.
Well, at one time, physicians thought that fish oil would provide benefits, but there were huge clinical trials, careful, blind, what we call blinded randomized trials, comparing fish oil with placebo. And there was no benefit. There was, however, harm. Fish oil increases the risk of atrial fibrillation. It's been shown in a number of studies. And that's the other problem with these supplements. Some of them have real harms. And because they're not regulated, the public doesn't know about those harms. Let me give you an example of harms. Some of these dietary supplements will actually interact with prescription medications to make the prescription medications metabolized faster or slower, leading to lack of effectiveness or to toxicity. So it's really, when people take dietary supplements, they have no idea whether they're beneficial or harmful.
The move from the FDA to the FTC, you said it was from the supplemental lobbyists, supplemental industry lobbyists. But was the idea that, well, they're natural, so they can't really hurt you. So we'll just say that they may not help, but we feel comfortable that they can't hurt.
Yeah. Well, the problem, of course, is that natural doesn't mean safe. There are wild mushrooms you can eat that will kill you. A lot of the things that, you know, that are considered poisons are actually derived from naturally occurring plants. So the idea that something that grows in the ground naturally is by definition helpful doesn't make any sense at all.
Tell us how your study was conducted.
So what we wanted to do is to provide some real evidence. So we offered people who had a clinical indication for a statin drug. This is one of the cholesterol-lowering drugs that have been so well studied over the years. They had to have a 5 to 20% 10-year risk of developing heart disease. And they were offered the opportunity to take a dietary supplement or to take one of one of six dietary supplements, placebo, or a very low dose of a highly effective statin known as rosuvastatin. We followed them then for the next 30 days, and we measured at the start their cholesterol levels and their levels of inflammation in the body. And then we measured it at the end of 30 days. And, you know, whenever you enter a trial like this, you don't know what it's going to show. I mean, we were very open-minded. We thought there was at least a possibility that some of the supplements might do something. They're certainly widely advertised. These are the most widely selling supplements. And I'll tell you what they were. They were fish oil, cinnamon, garlic extract, turmeric, plant sterols, and red yeast rice. Well, at the end of 30 days, none of them lowered cholesterol or inflammation. And one of them, actually, the garlic, actually raised the levels of bad cholesterol. And that was a statistically significant effect. And it is exactly what the concern is. In the absence of data, assuming that something is going to be helpful rather than harmful doesn't make good scientific sense.
What do we understand about the origins of these assertion that these things would help? I mean, do they come from somewhere?
I can't figure it out, you know.
Okay.
I've been doing this for 40 years. I know the scientific literature very well. You know, occasionally there's a fairly poorly done article that makes some claims about a supplement that when it's people try to replicate it, they can't replicate it. You know, some of it is just based upon folklore, you know. People that live in Italy have a low incidence of heart disease. So, and they use a lot of garlic in their food. So maybe garlic is helpful. And, mm-hmm. There is one more thing for people to be aware of. Many dietary supplements are contaminated with harmful substances, heavy metals, fish oil. A lot of the fish oil products are contaminated with mercury.
Because the fish are contaminated with mercury.
That's right. And there's nobody watching. There's nobody looking out for the public. We don't have, you know, tight FDA oversight. I'm going to tell you something I've said publicly, and I'll say it again. I could go in my backyard and cut up grass clippings and put them in a capsule and call it Nissen's Heart Tonic and claim that it promotes heart health and sell it in a drugstore, and nobody could stop me from doing it. That's how loosely regulated dietary supplements are.
So snake oil is still out there thriving on the shelves of your local drugstore.
This is 21st century snake oil. That's exactly what it is. I mean, you know, this goes back, you know, 100 years or more, people making these kind of wild claims that some natural substance was going to cure everything. And naturally, of course, it doesn't do any of that.
The study found that, as you said, rosuvastatin, the prescribed medication, did the best job in lowering the bad LDL cholesterol. And a 19% decrease in blood triglycerides. The drug is made by AstraZeneca, which funded the clinical trial you did. Can you talk about how you maintain objectivity when the company's funding it?
That's a very good question. First of all, you have to understand that rosuvastatin, which used to be known by the brand name of Crestor, is generic. the average patient pays about $3 a month for the drug. So there's nobody making any money from it. In fact, many of these prescription drugs are less expensive than the dietary supplements, which, by the way, cost Americans $50 billion a year. So we have a clinical trial center here that I look after, I run, that exists for exactly the reasons that you are raising, to provide independent and objective assessment of the effectiveness and the harms associated with therapies. Our statisticians do these analyses independently. They are funded by industry, and we do many studies like this, but industry has hands off. The data are in our possession. We collect the data. We analyze the data. We're scientists. I, for one, for the last 25 years, have refused to accept any honoraria, consulting fees, or any reimbursement for industry, because I feel like I have to maintain objectivity and maintain independence, because that's what serves the public interest.
If, you know, you mentioned the Mediterranean diet, and I'm wondering, you know, when I talk to my doctor about my cholesterol, they recommend a certain kind of diet. I mean, yeah. I guess the idea is that there's some elements of this stuff in a diet can help, or what?
Well, first of all, the Mediterranean diet has some very good evidence of benefit, but it's not a single dietary supplement. It's a way of life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I will, for one, think that probably what happens when people switch to a Mediterranean diet is they start eating less meat, more fish, more vegetables. They use, you know, healthy oils like olive oil. And so they're making dozens of changes in their behavior that at the end of a long period of time produce benefit. I believe in the Mediterranean diet. It's been studied. There was a 4,000 or 5,000 patient study funded by the Spanish government that looked at the Mediterranean diet and showed very good evidence. That's what the public needs to demand. If somebody tells you something's beneficial, then you have to ask, where's the beef? You know, where is the evidence? Show me the science. And it's hard for the public because junk science is everywhere. You know, if you go to the internet and you type in, you know, heart healthy supplements, you get every bogus claim in the world. And so it's really hard for the public to sort through the wheat from the chaff. But it's what you've got to do to stay healthy. Don't take dietary supplements. I will tell you, I tell my patients to take all their dietary supplements, whether they're for the heart or for anything else, and flush them down the toilet, because they don't know what they're taking.
What are statins? You know, the study shows that prescribed statins, not the supplements, are what's needed to reduce cholesterol. What do statins do? What are they?
Now, statins work on an enzyme in the liver. And that enzyme is responsible for the manufacture of cholesterol in liver cells, which is where cholesterol is made. When the liver cells become depleted in cholesterol, they pull cholesterol out of the bloodstream. And so it turns the liver cells into a little vacuum cleaner that's pulling the cholesterol out of the blood. And if the cholesterol is not in the blood, it can't get in the walls of the artery. And if it doesn't get in the walls of the arteries, it can't cause heart attack and stroke and all the other complications. So it's a wonderful thing. We have studies in hundreds of thousands of patients with statins showing that they reduce the risk of heart attack, cardiovascular death, stroke, and other complications. So incredibly strong evidence.
Dr. Steven Nissen, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
And it's a pleasure to be with you, and I hope I was able to help some people.
That's Dr. Steven Nissen. He practices in cardiovascular medicine in the medicine department at the Cleveland Clinic. And he is senior author of a new study that shows that all those $50 billion worth of natural alternatives or supplements for heart health and cholesterol management are a waste of money. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Nearly 5 million American children and adolescents were identified as being obese in 2022, and childhood obesity brings with it the same risks as for adults. High blood pressure, high cholesterol, type 2 diabetes, breathing problems such as asthma and sleep apnea, and joint problems. One thing most American children have in common is what they eat for breakfast and lunch at school every day. The Department of Agriculture last week responded to the threat with new school nutrition standards cutting sugars, fat, and salt, and increasing whole grains, and yep, there's backlash. Nutritionist Megan Lott is Deputy Director for Healthy Eating Research. It's a national program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann.
So can you talk about what these changes actually mean on the table in the lunchroom?
Yes. So last week, USDA proposed a rule to update the school meal nutrition standards for the first time in nearly a decade. The last time school meal nutrition standards were updated was in 2012. And since then, we've gone through a global pandemic that had major supply chain issues. There were many waivers or kind of rollbacks over the decade, weakening the standards. And we're really excited to see this rule, which moves in the right direction to really limit added sugars in school meals. It allows flavored milk in certain circumstances with limits on added sugars. It incrementally reduces sodium limits over many school years and really emphasizes products that are primarily whole grain with the option for occasional non-whole grain products. So we're seeing a movement back towards alignment with the dietary guidelines for Americans.
When the Department of Agriculture makes a change like this, how do they enforce it?
There are a number of ways they enforce it. I will say that I think in recent years, and especially given the struggles that school food service has been through with a lot of supply chain issues and labor shortages as a result of the pandemic, they are taking more of a carrot approach than a stick approach. So they are finding ways to really support and incentivize school food service operations moving towards implementing these standards as opposed to penalizing or punishing them for not doing so. But many food service is required to submit weekly or monthly menus to show that the menus they've designed are aligned with updated standards. They also are required to submit logs or reports of how many students are getting the school meal each month, and that's what their federal reimbursements are based on. And then they also do a series of visits, site visits to schools to do on-site evaluations of whether they're meeting a variety of standards.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I am talking with Megan Lott. She's Deputy Director for Healthy Eating Research. That's a national program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And we're talking about the new standards for school breakfast and lunch put forward by the Department of Agriculture last week, responding to the threat of obesity going through the roof among young children and adolescents. What parts of the program do you think will be the hardest to implement for, your garden variety school lunch program?
So I think that USDA has really proposed a step in the right direction with a gradual implementation approach designed to really support schools in meeting the updated standards. And so they have designed a series of grants to help schools that might need it most. So we tend to see, for example, lower resource schools in more rural areas in particular really struggle to meet a lot of these updated standards because they don't have as many staff and as many resources to help get them there. I also think we have some good support in terms of the implementation timeline, though I will say there are a couple of areas where I think we could implement faster. And again, taking that carrot approach of incentivizing schools. Personally, our program released research last week. It was a health impact assessment measuring what kind of impact these updated nutrition standards aligning with the dietary guide limits could have on schools and kids. And we really think there's strong evidence to show that the sooner we can update the standards, the better it is for schools' health and the better it is for school food finances. Because when schools serve healthier meals, more kids participate, which means more revenue.
What is the fact, how does the fact that, unlike the olden days when I was in school and there were actually ladies in the back in the kitchen making the sloppy joes for the day kind of a thing, a lot of schools' lunch and breakfast are mass produced. That requires preservatives. Does that factor into the challenges?
Certainly over the past 30, 40 years, really since the 1980s, there was a real shift on mass production of school lunches and this sort of heat and serve model where meals were largely produced in a kitchen and then shipped to schools. And it was just more of a heat and serve model. Recently, over the past 20 years or so, there's been a real push back in the opposite direction where more and more schools are moving back to scratch cooking or on-site meal preparation, which is great because, to your point, there are less preservatives in those school meals. But we also see boosts in meal quality, and kids are more likely to eat the food when it is not, you know, mushy vegetables and just that heat and serve old school TV dinner type model. And so we really are seeing a lot of schools moving in that direction. One area where schools do need resources, though, is to update school kitchen equipment. Because of that move back in the 1980s to really go to the heat and serve model, a lot of school kitchens haven't been updated in 30, 40 years. And so there are also, as part of USDA's plans, grants for school kitchen equipment upgrades, which is really vital to ensuring schools are really supported and able to do a good job on implementation here.
Is scratch production more expensive because it requires more, you know, labor at the local level?
It's really a shift in resources. You know, are you paying for the central kitchen model where you have staff there that are doing a lot of the scratch cooking? I think it could depend on the local economic situation too. It's hard to make a generalized statement there. Regardless, you have school food service staff on site at every school doing the heat and serve and the meal preparation. So in most cases, it's likely a shift of resources, though there may be some communities where it would be more expensive.
Organizations like the School Nutrition Association and the International Dairy Foods Association probably has a horse in this race, are concerned that this will not be received well by children, meaning that they won't eat it. What makes it so hard to introduce healthy eating to children in a way that makes them want to eat it?
You know, just like adults, kids really look or eat with their eyes before their mouths. So if something doesn't look super appealing or is very unfamiliar, they might be more hard pressed to try it. The good news is a lot of schools are doing wonderful things with nutrition education and local farm to school programs where there are a variety of ways through kitchen taste tests or introduction of different foods to really expose kids to new flavors and new varieties. And we have found that especially when you do that kind of involvement of kids where you're doing taste tests and really educating kids about the new item, they're more willing to try them. And, you know, a lot of kids just they need up to 20 exposures of a new food before they can actually decide if they like it or not. Hopefully some of those exposures are coming across the day, so not just at school, but we need to give them time and include them. They're the active constituent here. They're the ones eating the meals. We really need to include their opinions as we're updating the standards and making menu changes.
So talk about what's for lunch today in the classroom.
Again, it really varies from school to school. You know, I have three kids in elementary school in a local public school here in Durham, North Carolina, and they eat school lunch most days of the week. Today is a pizza day, but a big difference between a pizza day 30 years ago and a pizza day today is that slice of pizza comes with a salad on the side or green beans on the side, as well as a fruit. You know, when I was in school, the meal was typically pizza and French fries and chocolate milk. Now you see a much more balanced plate that really reflects the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, where pizza is part of the meal, but so, you know, half the plate is fruits or vegetables coming from these other items.
But still, the schools can never force a child to eat something, right?
No, of course not. But we have found actually that when the research supports that when schools are serving healthier meals, the participation in school meals, both from those children who are receiving free or reduced price meals based on income, as well as fully paying children, their participation in the program goes up. We've heard from kids in different qualitative research where they want healthier school meals, parents want healthier school meals. So we have really seen that when these healthier items are offered, kids are eating them. We have seen no increase in plate waste over the past 30 years.
And it's a pretty major pivot from the past few years, right? And since the pandemic, nutrition standards were relaxed because of difficulty obtaining certain foods and pricing issues and those kind of things. What's your sense about how schools will ramp up to these new standards?
Yes. I mean, firstly, our school food service departments around the country are heroes. They really stood up during the pandemic and made incredible adaptations to school food service programs to be able to still get meals to kids who were very hungry while they were stuck at home during homeschool. And when schools came back into session and there were still supply chain shortages, they used creativity to still find ways to meet the nutrition standards as best as they could. I think the good news is that we are seeing the supply chain issues largely get resolved. Inflation is still really high, which means that school food service dollars don't go as far. And so that's why one of our recommendations to USDA is to ensure that they're really also providing extra support and funding and training for schools to help them implement the new standards. Another thing we hope they'll consider is increasing those federal reimbursement rates so that each school meal is reimbursed at a higher dollar amount.
Well, that was a big hit when they ended the reimbursement for all children, right?
Yes. I mean, universal free school meals was one of the most significant waivers we've seen in our program's history. And this really enabled every child across the United States, regardless of income, to get a school meal for free. And this was really important. We saw this really have an incredible boost to school food service revenue. Participation was the highest it's been in the program's history. And importantly, stigma of participating in the program went down significantly. So it was no longer just that low-income children are getting this school meal, but every child was getting this school meal. Moreover, the research has shown that school meals, because they meet these nutrition standards, even when they were relaxed, are the healthiest meal most children are getting in an entire day. So there's incredible nutritional benefits and then these food service revenue benefits as well.
About how much does, I mean, if you do it on a per head basis, about how much does a school meal cost these days? Is there a range that you look at?
So the cost of production of a school meal is typically higher than the federal reimbursement rate. So I would have to go back and look. I believe right now the federal reimbursement rate is somewhere in the range of $2.79 to $3, depending on where you are. Certainly if you're in Alaska or Hawaii, the reimbursement is slightly higher. Mm-hmm. Most schools, in contrast, charge $3.50 or more for a fully paying child. So there
Per meal.
Per meal. Yep. And so that is still, you know, a very cheap school lunch or a very cheap meal for many of us. But I think there's a real gap there when you look at what they're charging for fully paying students versus the federal reimbursement rate, arguing, especially with inflation, that those reimbursement rates should be higher.
How do the whole grains, I know there's a, well, let's talk first about the whole sugar issue and how much sugar they can't use. They don't want them to use fake sugars, synthetic sugars, because they don't know what the effects could be on young children going forward, right?
That is correct. Currently, artificial sweeteners or non-nutritive sweeteners are not recommended for consumption among children. It is important to note that this is the first time USDA is promoting or putting forward an added sugar standard, which is really significant. And we think a really great advancement in the right direction. We know that, you know, in particular, school meals go above the recommendation by the Dietary Guidelines for Americans for added sugar, which is that none of us should have any more than 10% of our daily calories coming from added sugar. Currently, both breakfast and lunch are providing much, much more than that, almost triple that amount. And so, you know, this is a really significant boost that really stands to have strong improvements in the diet quality of children.
What are you going to be looking at and watching over the years? Because we know sometimes this takes a long time to have an impact. What are you going to be looking at as far as the impact on children and their weight and their other related health issues?
Yeah, some of the things that we have really monitored over the past decade and will continue to do so. So, for example, I mentioned our health impact assessment that came out last Friday. We were really looking at the impacts of healthier school meals on children's nutrition and health, their academic performance, and food security in particular. We also want to continue to examine the impact that healthier school meals can continue to have on food service revenue and meal participation. And in terms of kids' nutrition and health, it's not just childhood overweight and obesity rates, but also looking at diet quality, consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages, fruits and vegetables, whole grains. Are we seeing improvements in those areas? And ultimately, we would like to see those rates of overweight and obesity go down, but more importantly, we'd really like to see children's diet quality continue to improve.
When they lowered the limits for fat in school lunches some years ago, the school lunch providers upped the amount of sugar in, it's kind of a whack-a-mole proposition to make things taste good. Are you looking for other loopholes that may emerge with these new standards?
So when they reduced the fat limits back in 2010, 2012, they also added calorie limits based on age or grade level. So it is important to note that while we may have seen the added sugar go up slightly as a result, those calorie limits do still help to contain the total amount of added sugar or other nutrients of concern that children might be getting. But yes, most importantly, we really like to see the implementation timeline sped up a little bit, knowing this is going to take time for schools. We don't want to wait until, you know, 5 to 7 years from now to see full implementation. We definitely will continue to monitor the ability for schools to adequately incorporate whole grains. That has been a challenge for some schools. And really looking at sodium limits, those have been weakened quite a bit over the years. And so it's less of a loophole there, but more of industry pushback and pushback from schools because there haven't been that many products on the market meeting the original proposal.
Why are whole grains such a challenge?
It really depends on where you live. Sometimes it has to do with culturally appropriate food, or, you know, in the South, it's harder to find a good whole grain biscuit that kids will like and eat. Our argument is swap it out for a different whole grain product, but it has to do with product availability. Also, I think whole grain products, when fewer kids are used to eating those, the transition time there might be a little higher to get kids to like and accept those products.
Like granola versus Rice Krispies.
Right. And that doesn't mean we should give up on incorporating more whole grains, but I do think that is one that might take a bit more time for kids to get used to the new products and to really find products that work well in school meals.
Megan Lott, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thanks so much for having me.
That's Megan Lott. She serves as Deputy Director for Healthy Eating Research. That's a national program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And we've been talking about the Department of Agriculture last week announcing new school nutrition standards, cutting sugars, fat, and salt, and increasing whole grains. We will be back with more Wellness Wednesday, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We don't brush long enough. We press too hard with the brush, and there's a good chance that we're using the wrong type of brush. Consumer Reports last month published a guide with tips on the best practices when it comes to oral health. You can find a link to that article at wosu.org/allsides. Dentist Martina Bertolini is an assistant professor at the School of Dental Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. She is specially trained in periodontology. She also studies oral bacteria and fungi and how they affect oral and systemic health. Welcome to the show, Dr. Bertolini.
Hello, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
When it comes to oral care, how we brush and what we use to brush with are important. What are some of the basics that most people get wrong about how to brush?
Yeah, I think this is very important because we have to have a way that we brush that we're not going to hurt our gums. So ideally, we should not apply too much force because this can traumatize the gums. But also, we have to make it enough to be able to remove all the debris. So those are things we have to keep in mind when we're brushing our teeth.
How do you
and
know?
Also,
well, go ahead. No, go ahead.
And also, the 2 minutes mark is the ideal time that we should be brushing our teeth.
You know, I finally got an electric toothbrush, and it has a timer on it, and it really does make a difference. I was not brushing my teeth long enough before.
We don't realize. We think 2 minutes goes by very quickly, but if you're actually monitoring the 2 minutes, it's much longer than most people would expect. So this is one of the aspects that the electric toothbrushes with a timer usually can help you to make sure you did do your 2 minutes.
And then the pressure, another aspect of the electric toothbrush is it has a pressure, I don't know what you call it.
Sensor?
Sensor, yeah, that's right. That it tells me if I'm pushing too hard. It's just a higher buzz thing.
Yeah, so some of them, they actually stop vibrating if you're pressing for too hard. And some patients don't understand that. They think like, well, my toothbrush stops working. And I say, maybe this is when you press too strong. So those are things to pay attention. Not all electric toothbrushes have that. So I recommend my patients to just use the thumb and the pointing finger to hold the toothbrush. Just those two fingers.
Oh.
Because then you cannot apply too much force. If you're applying too much force, the toothbrush basculates and you're not able to brush.
I've noticed that dentists spend more time talking about how to brush teeth nowadays than they used to. Now, maybe it's because I'm older and I have more fragility in my mouth than I did when I was a youngster, but is that a thing?
Yeah, I think we're slowly realizing that going to the dentist twice a year is not enough if you don't keep good oral hygiene at home. So we are really trying to make sure that the way that we teach the patients is something that they will enforce on their daily activities. Because just once a 6 months or once a year is not going to be enough if they're not doing a good job at home. So we are trying more and more to make sure they're able to do their daily brushing and cleaning and flossing in a way that they'll keep their mouth health.
When it comes to electric toothbrushes versus non-electric, the Consumer Reports article says that electric may have a slight edge. Do you know why?
Yeah, so many factors play a role on that. And one is what we talk. People don't realize they haven't been brushing for long enough. But also is actually the sonic activity that not only dislodges the bacteria, but it really removes all the debris between the teeth, between the gum line. So it's not just the mechanic of you brushing the teeth, but also the stroke. So the strokes can go up to 20,000 strokes a minute, which you would never be able to do just with a manual toothbrush.
What about, I have a friend who swears by the water pick, you know, swears by it. What about those?
It's absolutely a great adjunct, especially for people that do not like to floss. I do, as you mentioned, a lot of research in autobiofilms, the bacteria, and I recently tested one of those actually for implant surface. People that have implants, they're not able to clean very well around it. It can get complicated. Mm-hmm. So those water flossers, they are very great adjunct because the pressure, it's called like fluid dynamics. It's very high pressure in a very small area. It really removes the bacteria in that site. So it's a great adjunct. It's not going to replace your brushing, your flossing, but it is a great adjunct. And it helps to keep the patients motivated. So really, at the end of the day, anything that makes you motivated, excited to brush the teeth, it's very good. And those have proven scientific results.
I have to say that now that I have that two-minute timer on the brush, sometimes I just start getting into it, and then all of a sudden it just ends. And it's kind of meditative in a way. You give yourself that little 2 minutes a day, or twice a day, yes. I should say.
Yes, absolutely. I think we don't realize, as I said, it goes by very quickly if you're just using the manual toothbrush.
I know electric brush prices can get steep, up to $200, but they don't have to be. I think I got mine for about 30, and it's nice. It's a Sonicare.
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing that I do recommend is some of them are rechargeable and some of them are battery operated. Mm-hmm. So the battery operated, slowly the battery dies and the pulsating movements are not as efficient versus the one that you can recharge. As soon as the charge goes below a minimum, it doesn't work anymore. So those are better because you always guarantee that you have the pulsating moments and the vibrations that you need versus the batteries that slowly die and you don't realize now they're not vibrating anymore. They're not pulsating as hard as they were.
And it's impressive. I mean, it holds a charge for 15 hours. So, I mean, if you divide that by 2 minutes, it's a long time.
It's a long time, yeah. Yeah, and usually you can leave it charging overnight, so it's not like you would need it at that very moment.
Right. There are such things as U-shaped electric toothbrushes that fit over your teeth all at once. How do they work, and what are your thoughts about them?
So those are interesting. I've seen them a lot for pediatric patients because usually they don't have the manual strategy to really brush around all their teeth. So the goal with that is using the same vibration movements that you would have in a sonic toothbrush. It involves all your teeth at once, sometimes top and bottom because the U shape they have. And ideally you'd be brushing all your teeth at the same time. So I think those can be an adjunct for kids. They are not there yet as far as sitting still for 2 minutes or having been able to brush all their teeth. But it starts to get complicated once they're transitioning through dentition. So you have teeth that haven't come yet, you have teeth that are not in position. Even for adults, if their teeth or the mouth shape doesn't fit the U shape of the toothbrush, mm-hmm. then you're not brushing them all. So it's not something that I usually recommend, but I see a place for it for certain kids. Sometimes like kids with like Down syndrome, something that they cannot really sit still or understand the need for it.
Tooth decay and gum disease can lead to larger health issues. What is the connection between gum disease and heart problems and diabetes? Why is there a connection?
Oh, I'm glad you brought this up. You know, it's one of my specialties, the periodontology. So many people don't realize, but if you have periodontal disease, that's an inflammation in your entire gums and bone. And if you close your hand, this would be the size of a wound if all your gums is inflamed. So the side of your hand closed, the palm, it would be an open wound, let's say, on your leg, on your arm. So what happens with that is you have so much bacteria there, and they can travel to other sites of your body. So even nowadays, you mentioned cardiovascular disease, you mentioned diabetes, but even Alzheimer has been linked to periodontal disease because those bacteria can travel to the brain. So we have two mechanisms by how it happened. One is the directly translocation of bacteria to those sites, but the other one, especially with diabetes, is the overall body inflammation. It creates a systemic inflammation in your body that it really exacerbates other conditions. So even rheumatoid arthritis has been started to be linked because of all this inflammation that you have in your body. So for diabetes patients, usually when you have a treatment in your periodontal status, sometimes it even improves your diabetes because it reduces some of the inflammation that you would have systemically. So everything is linked.
Is periodontal disease something that, is there a genetic component to it?
In some cases, that is a genetic component, but it's not the majority of the cases. So in many cases that we see a very aggressive and rapid form of the disease, especially in younger population, those sometimes are linked to a genetic component. But what we see most often is a chronic state of inflammation throughout the life. When the patient don't seek treatment or when the patient waits too long, then this inflammation really exacerbates. So in some cases, yes, there is a genetic component. In some cases, more local factors.
A lot of, across the board, our hygiene, our healthcare suffered during the early days of the pandemic. Fewer people were going into the offices. More people were homebound. They missed dental checkups. That was a big thing. I can still remember finally going back, you know, after a couple of years, which is, you know, if you have any kind of dental issues, that's a long time to go. What toll did it take on oral health? Are people getting back on track now?
Yeah, so this, you brought up a very good point. During the pandemic, because the patients stopped coming, when we did saw back those patients sometimes a year later, we saw a very rapid worsen of their disease status. So if they were on treatment, we saw it got very worse. But thankfully, they all understood the need for it. And the offices start to get even busier after the pandemic than they were before the pandemic, because I think people realize also being home, they're more aware of what they're eating, or the oral hygiene habits, and how it would impact their oral health. So they really got motivated to come back. And some people were still a little bit afraid to come back to the dentist. But we are one of the specialties that got more training to deal with that. We use the masks, we have the respirators, we have the filters. So I would say for anybody out there that is still skeptical or a little bit scared to go back to the dentist, we're very prepared post-pandemic to deal with those things.
You know, Medicare does not cover dental. You have to pay separately for that. And I'm wondering if you see a big drop-off among older people when they lose their insurance, they retire, that kind of a thing, and if that's a concern?
So I would say that some of the procedures are included, and I would like to bring this up, specifically the ones that are deemed preventive.
Okay.
So to go for your cleaning, to go for x-rays once every couple years, those are deemed like preventive treatments. They are included in most states. So I would tell people to go. Maybe my sample is biased on it because I'm in a university setting, but this is also something good to bring it up. The university setting usually see patients for a lower rate, and we do accept Medicare and everything. So for patients who are unsure if they can afford the treatment, universities are a very good place for them to start because the treatments are usually affordable.
And we're just about out of time, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are about toothpaste. There's way too many choices out there. What's some good rules of thumb?
Yeah, so we are getting to a time where everybody wants everything free of chemicals as much as possible and natural as much as possible. And I am that way too. But one thing that the American Dental Association do recommend is that you still keep fluoride in your toothpaste. So fluoride is the number one thing that will help people to not have cavities. So besides that, you can have very natural toothpaste with little to no other chemical components. But as long as you have fluoride, even for kids, then they should be preventing caries.
Dr. Martina.
One thing, if I can add sure. one point, mm-hmm. that I would not recommend are the ones with charcoal. They're getting very popular nowadays for brightening the teeth. Those are actually removing away the surface of your teeth.
The enamel, yeah.
Like slowly grinding them out. So I would not recommend. Those tend to be very abrasive.
That's Dr. Martina Bertoloni. She's an assistant professor at the School of Dental Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Have a good one.
You too. That's the end. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.